This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes, at Google Play, at Reason.com, or wherever you get your podcast on. And while you're there, rate and review us. We like to know what you think about what we're doing. My guest today is Camille Foster. He's a principal at Freethink Media. He's one of the co-hosts of the Fifth Column podcast. He's an entrepreneur, and he's also a libertarian of African-American persuasion, which actually we'll probably argue about that. We've got a lot of stuff to talk about with Camille. He's one of the most interesting people in the new media space as well as the libertarian space. So, Camille, thanks for talking.
Thank you for having me, Nick. Appreciate the invite.
Well, you know, let's get started about talking about Freethink Media. You recently released it, which is a video channel that or production company that was co-founded with you as well as with Dan Hayes and a couple of other people. Dan Hayes, a longtime Reason TV person. Mm-hmm. You recently released a video that is about a guy in Wisconsin whose kid was killed by police.
Yes.
And then he has fought for over a decade to change the way in which police investigate homicides or deaths at the hands of police.
Right. Yeah.
Give us the 30-second, the elevator pitch of
yeah,
that.
Yeah. So the name of this gentleman is Michael Bell, Sr. And in 2004, his son, during a routine traffic stop, was killed by police in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And Mr. Bell would spend a decade afterwards fighting to try and figure out exactly what happened that night. The initial investigation into his son's death lasted a total of 3 days. And at the end of that 3-day investigation, the police department in Kenosha said this was a totally legitimate, justified homicide. In fact, this young man tried to take an officer's gun.
That was their call. That was a homicide, or they were saying that it was a justifiable shooting.
Yeah. And he took issue with this. And being a guy who had been in the military, particularly in the Air Force, having seen crash investigations in the military, he knew that it didn't make a hell of a lot of sense to have the people who were responsible for his son's death be the same people who are principally responsible for investigating the death, because at a minimum, even if everyone had the best of intentions, even if it was just a mistake, you're not necessarily going to get to the truth. So his mission became, one, having his son's death thoroughly investigated, but two, fixing what he discovered to be a broken system. So he spent 10 years fighting and managed to make Wisconsin the first state in the union to pass a law requiring independent investigations of civilian-involved deaths resulting from police encounters.
And then it's had a spillover effect, so a bunch of other states have adopted similar
policies. A bunch of states have followed suit, and a bunch of cities in some cases have followed suit. And in some cases, you know, you had some policies on the books, and in many cases, you actually have district attorneys who actually conduct certain kinds of investigations after a police-involved death. The challenge there, however, as you well know, Nick, is that district attorneys and police departments work very closely together. They work together on hundreds of cases in any given year. They are very much co-workers.
What do you think is the, why is there such a ramped up interest in police process and police procedure? Which, I'm mm-hmm. totally in favor of. If you're not watching The Watchers, you've got big trouble.
Absolutely.
How much of this is a direct outgrowth of Ferguson? How much of kind of the Ferguson moment was itself an outgrowth of a long simmering, kind of set of, people being troubled by the way police were acting?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. And I've recently taken a look at this because of the work that I was doing on this project. I mean, our interest in criminal justice reform nationally comes after decades of a pretty uniform bipartisan consensus where we're tough on crimes, we throw people in jail for very long periods, and we throw away the key. Somewhere around the beginning of the first Bush administration, we find this bizarre circumstance where we start to talk about things like, well, these people are going to get out of jail. We need to find a way to make certain that they don't go back and find a way to integrate them back into our society. So the sea change in terms of our perspectives on what we ought to be doing with people who find themselves in trouble or have gotten into trouble in the past, and how we can make criminal justice reform a bit more humane, criminal justice system a bit more humane, is something that began long before Ferguson. And as I mentioned, this is a shooting that happened in 2004 with the Michael Bell case. The efforts towards getting that law changed, it took 10 years, but they began in 2004.
Right, so well before Ferguson.
Yeah, and I mean, even folks like IJ, who recently managed to get
Institute
the Civil
for
Asset
Justice,
Forfeiture program in Philadelphia completely dismantled, that's a case that they began working on, I believe, in 2004. So it's certainly the case that Ferguson and Black Lives Matter have helped to elevate these issues and make them part of a national discourse. But I think a lot of that was already happening, and a lot of the important victories have happened recently as a result of work that's been going on for a very long time.
What is, there's this bizarre disjuncture as well between Donald Trump's rhetoric. And I mean, he's not the only one, but he talks about America as if it's 1978 instead of 2018.
Like,
he's remembering
American
New York.
Carnage. Yeah.
Yeah. He's remembering, you know, high and rising crime rates of New York that were seemingly endless, where everybody walking down the street was a potential mugger or a potential victim.
Sure, sure.
Since the mid 90s, we've seen massive and ongoing decreases in violent crime and property crime, et cetera. What do you think is going on? I mean, and so, you know, in a way, it makes sense that we're finally addressing kind of the excesses of the criminal justice system, because it's 20 years after, and like, you know, let's figure out. But what do you think is driving people who look out on America today and all they see is is criminality and violence and a need to protect the thin blue line?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with just kind of the way we're designed, pessimistic bias. We have a tendency, especially where the media is concerned and news in general, to focus on negative stories, bad things that are happening. And certainly with Donald Trump, I mean, he tends to highlight the bad things that are happening in places like Chicago, where we have had some pretty uniquely high rates of violent crime.
But that's because of the Democrats, right?
Oddly,
when Democrats run cities where crime rates go down, they don't get credit for it.
Sure.
Right?
Well, I think it's the underlying policies. Yeah. Without any doubt. And in some cases, some of those bad underlying policies are pretty bipartisan. I mean, the war on drugs is certainly a huge component of what happens with respect to violent crime in a place like Chicago. And those policies are pretty universal. Do they fail harder there? No doubt about it. But they fail in similar ways in other places.
So it's kind of pessimistic bias, but it's also political opportunism, don't you think?
I think there's definitely some political opportunism involved there. And I mean, he does it because people respond to it. But I think there's also, a legitimate concern. When you happen to be the person who lives in Chicago, when you, like I do, live in Bedford-Stuyvesant, which Bed-Stuy in Brooklyn is, a lot of people know from sort of Biggie. That's where I first heard of Bed-Stuy. In fact, he used to refer to it as the do or die Bed-Stuy. But Bed-Stuy is a heck of a lot safer than it was. Still, it has elevated murder rates relative to other places. So I'm aware of it. I'm acutely aware of the crime and the violence that's there relative to where I was living in the financial district. And I think it's totally fair.
It's just a different kind of crime.
It's a different kind of crime, but there's still some murders. They're just fewer.
No, yes, I agree. But the murder of the whole economy, dreams of a generation.
Well, that and some legitimate straight up violent crime, But I was saying that there's at a minimum, there are legitimate concerns that people have who live in places like that, where they have lower crime overall in New York City, but still elevated relative to the rest of the city in places
and
like that.
I mean, for God's sake.
So talking about it is good.
Yeah, and you should be able to live with it, live in a place in America without fear for your life.
I think that's exactly right.
So how does that video, which is available at Freethink's website, on your Facebook page or YouTube channel, how does that exemplify what Freethink Media is about?
Well, what we really wanted to do with that piece, and I certainly can't take all the credit, we have an amazing team, but what we really wanted to do was try to disrupt kind of the standard narrative about that. I mean, we tend to talk about police shootings in this day and age, primarily with respect to racial disparities in the number of police shootings. But there are two things that we wanted to do with this piece. One was present a broader, fresh way of looking at the problem. But two was to focus on someone who was doing more than talking about what's wrong, but was articulating some sort of interesting new approach to fixing what is wrong. And that really is the ethos of Freethink. We describe it oftentimes as Vice meets Ted. We tell stories about the ideas and the people who are shaping the future. And for the most part, what that means is finding old, persistent problems, even emerging problems, and bringing some new, innovative idea to bear to try and fix the problem.
One of the series that you guys do that I find fascinating has to do with kind of technology, and it's It's not quite transhumanism, but
I think
the
superhuman is the name of the series.
So Dan directs talk a bit about that and what that is doing in terms of like looking at persistent problems and then kind of coming up with new or alternative solutions.
Yeah, and I mean, the superhuman tends to focus on a lot of medical innovations. So oftentimes, I mean, these are problems that folks are very familiar with. It's diabetes.
Yeah.
And cancer and all sorts of different genetic disorders. And there is a universe of people who are doing interesting stuff there. Sometimes it's a mom who has worked on the periphery of the genetic sciences, but not really as a researcher, who finds that her daughter has a genetic malady and does the incredible thing of starting a new business and creating a pioneering new treatment that has extended her life, her daughter's life, and the lives of thousands of other people. For us, it's all a matter of not merely profiling the technology, not because sometimes things work and sometimes they don't, but really celebrating the values and the ideals that are necessary for people to believe that they can go out and do this and have an opportunity to go out and do this, i.e. solving big problems. So that's really what we're all about at Freethink, highlighting the work that these exemplars do. And it's all rooted in this idea, this belief that we have, that humans are curious about what other humans are up to. And while most of the news that we consume tends to focus on the things that are broken, the things that are wrong in a pessimistic way, the most untold and really, frankly, most important story is all of the things that are amazing and that are getting more remarkable with time. So that's what we do at Freethink.
So talk about Freethink as a new media company. New media is a ridiculous term. Social media is also kind of a ridiculous term. But
we could just be a media company.
Okay, so you're a media company that's up and about now, and your primary distribution outlets are the internet, including YouTube and Facebook and whatnot.
Yeah, primarily
digital. You were a co-host of The Independents on Fox Business.
Yeah.
What is it better to be in the media space you're in now than a model? not that particular show, but I mean, like, to be on a cable news network.
Yeah.
And what is better about where you are now versus where you were?
Well, certainly at one, I mean, The Independents was a tremendous amount of fun. I love doing that show. It was a formidable experience for me. And I love Kennedy and Matt and all the rest of the great folks from Reason who were frequently guests on the program. It was just great. But it's certainly the case that cable television, while I still occasionally do that, I am more inclined to turn down those invitations. I mean, you get a 3-minute segment where you get to talk for maybe 30 seconds of that 3 minutes, and it's an important issue that you care about deeply, but you never really get into. Online, you have so many more opportunities to, especially for me, being a partner in a media company, to tell the story you want to tell it in a patient and thoughtful way, to structure things. You know, the phrase sort of democratization of media is something you hear a lot. But the reality of that is lower costs, equipment that's much cheaper, and an ability to experiment with things I'm thrilled and delighted to be able to play in that space and do some of that experimentation.
Do you worry at all about, you know, one of the arguments in this, you don't hear it as much anymore because I guess it's kind of taken for granted, but when new media, such as it was, started coming up, people worried a lot about the fragmentation of the audience. And that as Americans, you know, we would all be watching our own individualized news services, so we would have nothing in common.
Uh-huh.
Do you worry about that at all?
I really don't. I think it's wonderful, the specialization that happens, because it's generally not tailored for one person. It might be tailored for 15 or 20 or 30,000 people, but it's not as though it's the only thing that they have in common. I think that there is a real opportunity in allowing more companies to be out there, more creators, quite frankly, to be out there creating content for audiences from their particular point of view. Some of those things will appeal to a niche audience. Some of them will surprising to the creators themselves, in many cases, become breakout hits that appeal to billions of people.
That's
an opportunity to create new overlap, not to sort of silo us all into our unique particular interests.
And it's also interesting that, you know, one of the arguments used to be that the media, the big companies, wanted to fragment us so that they could sell us stuff more effectively, whereas a lot of media now is effectively kind of post-advertising almost, where it's, you know, what are you selling? But what constitutes a breakout hit for Freethink Media?
Well, it depends. I mean, we've got different metrics. Obviously, mm-hmm. we're interested in view counts, but rather than just the view counts you see on YouTube, we're interested in completed views. Mm-hmm. So, you know, our numbers are all over the place. I think our biggest video, our smallest video in terms of view count is probably one we just released because it's on its way up. Our biggest is probably
that's very optimistic that you are always releasing your least viewed video.
Yeah, yeah.
We've got a couple at Reason going back. I mean, we've been around for, I think, 11 years or so now. And yeah, it's coming out. It's 11 years, and we've got a couple that are still in triple digits, and they're not. There's short of an alien invasion of somebody interested in Thomas Jefferson's moose.
Yeah, yeah. There's a mistitled video. Someone needs to watch and appreciate those. But our biggest, I mean, you know, 40, 60 million.
Wow.
You know, every video doesn't have to do those kinds of numbers to be a success for us, but they've got to be on brand. They've got to tell a story mm-hmm. to the audience that they'll care about. And they've got to really give us kind of another, at a minimum, every single video that we do is a legitimate learning experience. It's another opportunity to experiment with oftentimes what are very new ideas for everyone, including our team. So I don't know that we have any failures, any duds.
That means you don't have any successes. It's the same thing with children. If you don't have failures as kids, you don't have successes.
I've only got one.
Well, there's a lot riding on that.
But there's something you said a moment ago, which is a favorite pet peeve of mine with respect to like tailored ads on platforms like Facebook. I've never quite understood the frustration with finding yourself in an ecosystem where the ads that you're getting are more relevant to you. They're more likely to be things you care about. And rather than just being ads for big box retailers, for the car that everyone is buying, the same pair of blue jeans.
A craft store. Yeah, every time I'm pulling stuff out of my mailbox and it's like for Michael's Crafts or something.
Absolutely.
Like, what the fuck?
Yeah. I mean, these are small brands that are upstarts in many cases that you would have never heard about before.
Do you worry, this is going in a slightly different direction, but do you worry at all about ads, you know, whether it's Facebook or YouTube or Google or Twitter, I guess, like when they start to recommend stuff or they start to show stuff to you that, you know, that it's kind of shutting down that freewheeling experience that some of us remember the internet as being, that, you know, you're being, you know, they're trying to edge you a little bit closer to the same thing over and over again.
You know what? There's always been some kind of curation mechanism happening on the internet. And generally speaking, that curation has made the experience more rich. I am bullish on innovation, and I'm bullish that if Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube are sort of forcing you into the same thing over and over again, and you're not seeing stuff that's interesting, someone else will come along and start to deliver that experience.
You're keeping your gab ready so that you can.
I never set one up, but that's because I've got limited online time.
What do you think of the fear that people have about social media in various ways, including the ability of social media, again, let's just say media, the lowering of the costs of entry to media so that everybody now has a printing press. Everybody has a TV studio. Everybody has a radio network. That it is creating a semi-insanity in the discourse where people are more violent and vitriolic and hateful or dumb, you know, because it's rageaholism as opposed to, you were talking about, like, let's have these long, thoughtful kind of discussions.
Sure.
Do you think that's being crowded out, or that's also happening and it's just that a lot of people, particularly in the legacy media, want to focus on the vitriol and the hate you know, it's their lunch that's getting eaten?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, the internet in all of its wonderful marvelousness, there's no limitation on the number of people that can be trying to have a conversation right now. It's less a function of things getting crowded out and more a function of stuff not yet finding an audience. So it's certainly the case that the loudest voices tend to be the ones that are screaming obscenities at one another and demagoguing someone for being awful, for not conforming to their particular point of view. But I think that just gives people like me at Freethink, and quite frankly, folks like you guys at Reason, who are routinely telling stories about people who are doing cool and interesting stuff and trying to rise above
or
the partisan fray.
Or being killed by the police.
Yeah, or being killed by the police, which is an important story to elevate. But almost lost my train of thought there.
So that there is more voices than ever.
More voices. So yeah, so there are a lot more voices out there telling these stories, and I don't worry at all that we're approaching a point where it's impossible to break through. There's never been a shortage of content on the internet, but the things that we can do to ensure that we stand out are produce premium, high quality content, and to tell stories in a way that is likely to resonate with people. There's a lot of cat videos, and I don't know that people really want to only watch those undifferentiated cat videos. I think we can do better than that.
I'm getting into big cat videos, which is, I guess, a superset of that. But so talk about The Fifth Column a little bit. This is a podcast that started out. It was you, Matt Welch of Reason, and mm-hmm. Michael Moynihan, now mm-hmm. of Vice, formerly of Reason. Mm-hmm. Anthony Fisher, late of Reason, also involved these days. Mm-hmm. Is that connected to Freethink at all?
It is in the sense that I'm involved.
Okay.
Freethink has helped to bankroll it.
And this is a popular freewheeling discussion. What are your hopes for the Fifth Column?
Well, the aspiration began as an excuse to get together with Moynihan and Welch once a week and hang out and do stuff. I think what it's evolved into is I've sometimes described it as like reliable sources with meat cleavers. Like we show up and we kind of bash the hell out of each other and out of the news cycle, and not merely to be kind of anarchist about it and blow stuff up, but really to try to get to the meat of what the most important narratives of the day are about. What is the substance of the story? How is it being covered? My own aspiration is to try to cultivate a greater sense of skepticism among the public. And when I say that, I mean it is differentiated from cynicism. Cynicism right. is you don't care
that.
When
actually,
something is sort of true
I'm
or false.
I'm sorry, I'm stepping on your words. Go back to that distinction between skepticism and cynicism.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
seems central to a conversation that we're having without realizing. So explain that.
Well, good. I hope so. Well, cynicism is you are generally disinterested in whether or not something is true. You're sort of shitting on things and castigating them, and it generally speaking suggests that you're not really listening very close at all. Skepticism is a lot more a function of you approaching something as a serious, rational person trying to get to the heart of the matter. I've sometimes described it as, you know, a miner like goes into a pit. They come out with some sort of stone, and you want to know whether or not this is a precious metal, a piece of fool's gold, or an actual hunk of gold. Figuring it out is incredibly valuable to you. And I think really cultivating skepticism among consumers of the media, especially in a time when we talk a lot about post-truth, mm-hmm. the sensibility that I find most often amongst people who are casual or even serious readers of the news is they want objective journalism, someone to tell them the truth and explain precisely what happened. And reality is complicated. And objectivity, even for news people, is a different sort of thing.
But you do want people who are acting in good faith, right?
Well, you do. But I think cultivating skepticism amongst the general public is a fantastic way to hold journalists accountable and to keep them audience and really to force them to be rigorous.
Do you feel like we're getting smarter? I mean, you know, one of the things that there's a social learning curve in everything. And when you look back at, you know, women coming into the workplace. Hmm. You know, there's a decade-long social learning curve of how to deal with that in a way where everybody's
still learning.
And it's the same thing. You know, there are racial issues, there are class issues, media issues. Do you feel like we are sharper readers of the news or of the world around us than we were 10 or 15 years ago? Or are we just overwhelmed? And you know, and particularly in an era of Trump. You know, who, again, is he's the effect. I don't think he's the cause of this.
I think that's
right.
But
people go into blind rages if, you know, either you're anti-Trump or pro-Trump. And it's like it's certainly not skepticism, and it's even beyond cynicism. But are we getting better at reading the news or reading the world?
I'm an optimist, but I don't know that we are. And I think that my instincts are, and I just don't have a lot of analytical stuff that I can connect this to right now. But my instincts are that it has a lot to do with the supposition that we bring to the enterprise of journalism, both journalists themselves imagining themselves as completely objective truth tellers who are simply distilling the facts for people, and in some cases believing themselves great heroes who are on brave missions, and a public who generally believes that. Either journalists are scientists who are practicing some craft that they don't quite understand, or maybe they're magicians who are sometimes divining the truth and can simply, again, just bring it and present it in front of you. I think we would be on a path towards sort of a better educated, more literate society in terms of media literacy if people had a sensibility that, of course, journalists are people too. They bring perspectives to the stories they cover, and it's necessary for me to think about the various ways in which this complicated story has been distilled to 500 words and what corners essentially had to be rounded in order for it to fit in that medium. And are there perhaps important things that I should consider about the reasoning that went into how this was reduced and compacted for my convenient consumption?
Let's do what I think J.D. Salinger in Catcher in the Rye called the David Copperfield crap. How old are you and where did you grow up?
I just turned 38.
38? Holy cow, you're getting up there.
I'm a
it's
baby.
All over now, baby.
I'm in my prime, honestly. Yeah. I've never felt better. I've never been healthier and stronger and more handsome. I am
from... You know what? Don't sell yourself short, because as Joe Namath said, you know, you can get better looking every... tomorrow you're going to be better looking.
No,
than today,
I hope so. I hope I continue to get better.
So you're 38. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Washington, D.C., in and around there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Maryland, Virginia, close enough to the city, you call it all D.C. My family's from Jamaica, so I'm first generation American
You were born in America.
I was born here. Yeah. My mom came here when she was a couple of months pregnant with
me. What did your parents do?
My mom was, she's worked a number of different service jobs in various industries. My stepdad, who's raised me since I was 2.5, sold cars.
Really?
And
what kind of cars?
So it's pretty blue collar. He sold my mom a Toyota, a busted Toyota.
And
a lemon.
And himself.
She had to keep coming back to the dealership over and over again because it didn't fucking run right. Managed to seduce her. He was 20 years his junior, and he still pulled it off. It's a hell of a man.
I have to say that where I come from, being a car salesman isn't blue collar. That's kind of aspirational. You know, it's like being the guy washing the car is the blue collar job. And then you went to college?
I went to University of Maryland, College Park. I actually took a very long time to finish there because in my second or third year, I started a telecommunications consulting company.
Explain this, because now, does that industry even still exist?
Well, telecom still exists.
Yeah, telecom
but at
does,
the time, what we were doing was brokering internet services. And I mean, initially, it was just straight up broadband services. We were selling these things called T1s that almost no one has heard of, and DSL, which almost no one has anymore. But we were helping people
decide
which providers to use.
These were essentially high-speed dedicated lines for internet or other kinds of data transmission.
Precisely. And we were brokering services from different vendors, allowing people to compare speeds and offerings.
How did you even get into, because that to me, and you know, I'm a fucking professional libertarian. I have no entrepreneurial bones in my body. How do you even learn about that?
My buddy had a job at MCI WorldCom as one of their youngest salespeople. And it was just the briefest of moments where people were being these independent reps for telecom services. And we were one of the first people to start doing that kind of thing online. And were able to find, in some cases, pretty large, great distributed companies who needed our services. And we fixed a deficiency in the market. But when I started, I wasn't a sort of free market oriented. I developed some instincts around that over time.
Yeah, let's talk about, what is your libertarian origin story? Where you know, a sailor lures you to a bar and then you wake up the next morning and you're like, fuck it, I am a libertarian.
Yeah, well, it's weird. It actually began by me becoming effectively a conservative because I realized I wasn't quite a Democrat.
Ask, I mean, you know, as a black person or growing up black in America, is it hard to recognize, and I'm thinking we were talking before the show about Kanye West, and I, you know, the guy who got the worst end of all of the stuff that happened to Kanye recently was Chance the Rapper, who said, you know, when he said, hey, you know what, like, you don't have to vote Democrat if you're black, but I assume that is actually like that's a pretty daunting realization, because it's a very tight fit between being Black or African American and being Democrat.
Yeah. Well, as I mentioned, I'm first generation American, right. And Caribbean people of recent African ancestry and native born Blacks here in America, there is a schism there.
Yeah.
And so I've never quite grown up with a sensibility that I am narrowly a part of the Black community writ large. I always say that people from the Caribbean are conveniently Black. You know, when you're ready for it, Barack Obama is your guy. Other times you refer to native born Black people as them.
Yeah. Right. I grew West up around Indians, that. I believe in, you know, when certain types of, education and income outcomes come down, West Indians actually do much better than average Americans.
West Indians and African
immigrants.
I'm
from the New York area, Irish and Italian, and they're always well below the Caribbeans.
Yeah. No, they do a spectacular job. And I mean, it has a lot to do with sort of self-selection as well. But I think
they're not doing so well in Jamaica.
Distinctions. That's precisely right. If everything was perfect there, we would be fixing that and just stay in the better weather.
That's like it was for a long time when the Chinese, you know, somehow the Chinese were really successful everywhere but in China. It's like what's going on here. So you realize you weren't a Democrat.
Yes.
So you became, being a Black conservative like about the worst experience that you've had?
I don't know, because I've never quite checked that box. I wasn't a conservative long enough in any sort of a formal way. And my own political awakening kind of took place. I was in isolation. I was on campus, but I didn't have a community of people. I was discovering stuff to read online. So it started with Milton Friedman and Bastiat's The Law. Those were the first two things I read that totally changed my perspective. But then I was fortunate to discover, now it sounds like you asked a self-serving question, Reason and Mises and reading you and Michael Moynihan.
Oh, that's very
and Matt
flattering.
Welch.
Thank you.
That completely opened my eyes to a new way of approaching issues that I hadn't really thought about.
At the risk of, making this even more of a tongue bath, what was it that was different, or what was it that was appealing?
Well, I had, at that time, I was an economics major. So I think for a lot of libertarians, there's something about kind of the fundamental, essential nature of things, rationalizations that happen as a person who's focused on economics, the notion that, well, when you go to buy something, it has a price. Well, how do those prices emerge? There's something very appealing about kind of the analytical, rigorous, philosophical nature of libertarian thought. And being able to benefit from the great writing that was happening at Reason and continues to happen at Reason, quite frankly, I still benefit from it, gave me an opportunity to sort of see like the connection points between these particular ideas and seeing them in application in different contexts. So from issues related to everything from sort of organ transplants and creating a market for human organs, how could that lower prices and make them more available to people, hence saving lives? So why do we have these prohibitions again? There's something about that systematic thinking that was just intensely appealing to me. And when it came to the conventional media and reading stories about these things, it was just so surface level. There's so much baggage that people bring to those conversations, the default presumption that this is wrong, so we can't do it. That's all there is to say, apart from whatever other thing is sort of pernicious and bad at the moment.
Do you consider yourself more of an anarcho-capitalist or a libertarian, and where is the borderline?
Yeah.
These things? And I'm curious, am I like the migrant caravan? I'm kind of in libertarian land, and I might be getting towards the anarcho-capitalist border.
Yeah. I personally describe myself as an anarcho-capitalist. Murray Rothbard's work was also really important to me, because it made so much of libertarianism come alive to me. The notion of, as was David Friedman's work and Robert Nozick, the notion that you could push these ideas to their very limits, find the place for sort of maximum amounts of freedom. There's always been something really inspiring and encouraging to me about that. The notion of people being able to live their lives in whatever way they want, while still granting other people the ability to do the same.
Do you feel like we're getting further and further away from that as a nation? I mean, you know, not that we ever were, but I mean,
it's a great point.
You know, it, but it's, you know, is that even aspirational to anybody anymore?
I don't know how to describe that. I mean, I think there are ways in which things have become undeniably better. You know, the consensus around what are human rights and sort of the negative liberty sense is pretty remarkable. I mean, I can't imagine that most of our ancestors several hundred years ago would have imagined that we would live in the kind of world that we do now with that. And the aspiration for most humans on the planet is to create a world where even more people enjoy the right to property and life in that fundamental sense. The modern battles that we're having about the degree to which we should expand human rights to include all sorts of other things that are, in some cases, you know, nice to have, and in other cases, yes, essential, but, you know, you have a right to a home. Well, what kind of home? How many square feet should it be? Should I get a pool or not?
Or you have a right to be able to buy a home.
Yeah,
you don't get a home
precisely
delivered to you upon birth. I
think that is a tension that we're going to have to navigate more and more. And it's a conversation that's going to be very challenging, I think, for increasingly challenging for libertarians, especially in the populist moment we find ourselves in.
So what is the threat of populism? And somebody like Murray Rothbard, obviously, towards the end of his life or at various phases, flirted very heavily with populism. He liked Pat Buchanan, who is really, in a lot of ways, probably hasn't gotten his full due as kind of the premonition of Donald Trump.
When you look back,
you know, in terms of culture war, in terms of trade wars and things like that. He also, Rothbard, of course, famously entertained David Duke as an interesting character.
Yeah.
What is
some embarrassing political pragmatism there?
Yeah. What is it about populism, I guess, first, that you think is appealing to people? And then secondly, what is the best way for libertarians to kind of push back against that? So, why is populism appealing?
Yeah, the latter question
is right-wing and left-wing,
right?
Yeah. I mean, there's right and left-wing populism.
I think there is, but the difference between those two things is rather thin. It might be sort of nationalist sentimentalism that is the real differentiator between those two things, because at bottom, the rest of it is all kind of protectionism and fear of the outsider who might, in fact, make it harder for you to get the wage that you're after and to buy things at the prices that you think they ought to be at. Generally, I think it's not tremendously dissimilar from the push for greater security and certainty that I think folks like Jonathan Haidt have written a lot about in other contexts when it comes to speech. I think a lot of the same dynamics are playing out in society in different ways.
So that Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump are more similar than they're different.
That's certainly
been
my perspective.
And not in a cheap way, but yeah.
Yeah, in the most fundamental sense imaginable.
And so do you see populism is partly, I guess, it's an interest in making sure that the system isn't rigged. That in an earlier age, it would have been the international banker, the Jew or somebody like who is rigging things so you never get what you're worth. But it's partly that, but then it's also stabilizing the world so that invaders aren't coming, it's foreign goods or foreign people. And
that's
Trump,
right.
I guess, is kind of fascinating because he's equally disgusted by foreign people as well as foreign goods, there seems to be. Whereas Sanders is anti-immigrant. I mean, he hates the idea of open borders.
He has been historically, absolutely.
And he's a protectionist, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, Elizabeth Warren is a protectionist, economic protectionist. But do you feel as if is the world more fluid, or is it that we are talking about it in a way that makes people feel like they will not be able to predict what things are like in 5 years? And so now they kind of seize up and they're like, no, let's shut it down.
Yeah, I would definitely say that the world is more fluid in some important respects. I mean, one, I think we have media is great for communicating some of the radical changes that are happening. In some cases, it's not as amazing, perhaps, for some people as going from no refrigeration to refrigeration. But to go from having payphones every couple of blocks to having supercomputers in your pocket that allow you to communicate with people on the other side of the world for free, you know, this is a remarkable shift. And it's something that I think is incredibly unsettling for folks. And I think it's even true in our politics, right? Like perspectives on things like gay marriage, on drug legalization, hopefully, I think, on sex work in the near future, have shifted pretty radically over a very small period of time. And I'm not sure we've seen something like that before, certainly not in like our modern politics. So I think the, I mean, the rate of change has probably been unsettling.
My childhood, you know, when Fleetwood Mac released Tusk, you know,
I don't know anything about that.
Yeah, well, I'm just saying it was like it was too much. People couldn't follow them after Rumors. It was like, no, this is too big a change.
Yeah.
I mean, you're talking about stuff that's orders of magnitude bigger than, I mean, in a few years, it seems like we've gone from, in a weird way, a very buttoned down culture to, you know, pretty freewheeling, and it keeps going. And of course, I think almost at any 5 or 10 or 20 year chunk, you could say that.
But, yeah.
But it does feel as if some of this change is accelerating, which then makes people want to, you know, you get nervous,
yeah,
right, if you don't. So how do we, if libertarianism, and this might not be the way that you would define it, if not redefine it, but if libertarianism is kind of, you know, we're definitely pro-globalism, or, you know, we're not bloodless cosmopolites or anything, but it's like, yeah, you know.
And we're not all Jewish.
That's right. Yes. But we may all be male, at least in this conversation, right? Are mostly male. But what is the way that libertarianism can sell a vision of a world that is more fluid in all sorts of ways, and that is freer and more innovative, but that's also comforting to people, so that people don't flip out and say, I am afraid of this or that particular change. I'm afraid I'm not going to exist in a couple of years.
Yeah.
So I want to freeze everything as it is. Is there?
I don't know. I want to turn the question back around on you. I mean, the truth is that it's the thing I think about quite a bit. Mm-hmm. But it's challenging. I'm not sure. My main thing with respect to my philosophical and political beliefs and the things that I do and sort of the commentariat amongst the commentariat is to try to be involved in the conversation, to try to demonstrate that we have mutual concerns and interests. Mm-hmm. None of us want to see lots of people go to jail. None of us want to see people go to jail unnecessarily. None of us want to see people die unnecessarily. Right. So starting with that shared premise, how can we proceed from here? Mm-hmm. Perhaps we should do something about the drug war. Perhaps we should approach this issue of police-involved shooting in a different way that doesn't sort of center on whether or not there are racial disparities, but centers on, well, what can we do to actually fix this problem? Beginning from a place of mutual concern and shared interest, and proceeding with the belief, just from on the basis of reciprocity, that people are sane and reasonable and can eventually be persuaded, I think is the way I've chosen to try to advocate for the ideas that I know we both care about, and a lot of people listening do. Is that something that you can scale? Is it the best way to go forward? I don't know. I hope so. I mean, it's what I'm most inclined to do. But I don't know. I can't be prescriptive for everybody else.
You have a 1-year-old daughter, basically.
Yeah, 11 months today,
11
actually.
11 months, okay.
Yeah.
And your wife is an entrepreneur, a successful entrepreneur.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Are you excited by the future? And this is, I'm thinking, I have kids of my own who are 24 and 17. And one of the things that I think, even though you're ancient at the age of 30, you're part of a generation, perhaps, where regardless of where you start out in life, you expect your job, or you expect what you do in your productive life to express who you are or what you care about in a way that I was kind of born into that expectation. But it's, you know, when I look back, all of my grandparents came over in the 19-teens and they were just, you know, trying to get food to put on the table. My parents were kind of like, we work so that we can enjoy stuff on the weekends or maybe in the evenings, and our kids will be able to live lives that express themselves.
Yeah.
Do you feel like that is generally accepted now? And then is that a punishing? I mean, is it punishing to people to say, like, not only do you have to support yourself, but you have to support yourself in a way that actually reveals who you are and what you care about? Is that a tough burden to bear?
I hope it's not a tough burden to bear. I think most people seeking that kind of self-expression in their own career, it's interesting because I've done, you know, a lot of hiring, generally people who are younger than me at every stage. And a lot of young people sort of are in the job market looking for a job that completely satisfies them. And what I suspect is probably more challenging and burdensome is carrying the expectation that work will always be satisfying in that way, discovering that I'm paying you because it's not, and I still want you to show up.
Yeah, that's
right. Like, they will defect from those jobs. So it's great if you can find it and have it. The interesting thing about entrepreneurship is you're trapped in that gig for a while. You've made some long-term commitments and can't just up and leave. But you also have to do a lot of things that are definitely dissatisfying in many instances in order to keep the business viable. I certainly grew up with some expectations around being able to do something that I love as a career. And I think that it's good and it's useful, but I also have grown up with the sensibility that not everyone is going to be able to save penguins for a living. And kind of going out and earning your nut might require you to do some things that you don't care about. And you could find places for self-expression beyond the workplace, which I'm privileged to be able to work with a remarkable team doing something that I hope is world changing. But I also make it a point to find sources of inspiration and encouragement elsewhere. So I think some balance on that score is very good, but I don't know that it's necessarily a bad thing.
What is your greatest hope for your daughter?
That she will be thoughtful and rigorous, and that she won't allow anyone to make decisions for her about what she ought to believe, including myself. I hope she'll always try to be her own person, that she'll never feel confined to fulfill some expectations that people have for her on the basis of her appearance or her gender. You know, it's something that's important to me. And it could be that she reaches her own conclusions and disagrees with her father on everything after I've disowned her. You know, I'll still love her, but I hope that she'll do that, because that's been amongst the most important and fulfilling things for me, to continue to be my own person and to really know myself, as the philosopher has encouraged us to do. It's been a great and exciting journey. So I hope she's able to enjoy that.
Well, that is spoken like a true anarcho-capitalist parent, and we'll check in a couple of years and see if you still
see how
feel
it's going.
That way. And,
yeah.
Well, I want to thank Camille Foster for talking to me at the Reason Podcast. He is a principal at Freethink Media. He's one of the co-hosts of The Fifth Column. Check him out all over the place. Camille, thanks so much for talking.
Thank you, Nick. I appreciate it, man.
This has been The Reason Podcast. I've been your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes, at Google Play, at Reason, or wherever you get your podcast on. Rate and review us while you're there. Thanks so much for listening.